So as to the matter at hand, for the last day or so, I've had a very enjoyable experience. I re-encountered this book. Fragrant Palm Leaves. How many, by Thich Nhat Hanh, how many people know this book? Well, if you, any, how many people know who Thich Nhat Hanh is? Right, very well known, not only as a Buddhist meditation teacher, father of mindfulness, but also just, you know, many people are affected by his teachings. We know that Martin Luther King nominated him for Pulitzer and for the Nobel Peace Prize. Anyhow, this is a very unusual book. I've read it many times, forgotten everything, so it was quite wonderful to connect with it again. These are his very personal journals from 1962 to 1966, not all of them, the majority of which were written when he was in the States. He was on a Fulbright, so he was at Princeton, he was at Columbia, a little bit at Cornell, so over a couple of years. So he was away from Vietnam, away from his monastic, and he was really in a very, he was in his 30s. He was learning a lot. So you can see he was a lot of gestation for all the 100 books and teachings that you know, that we came to know in the 80s and the 90s and the last 20 years. So anyhow, and it's very personal. Anyhow, it gives you an insight. So I wrote down a couple of things that I found interesting that I wanted to talk with you about today. But it's interesting that when I came in this morning, so the retreat that's going on is transforming the inner critic. Everybody sort of know what an inner critic is. Many people carry such a thing inside themselves, right? Outwardly, we don't like to show people, but many people have inwardly a voice that is always, we could say it's not very supportive and kind to oneself, and if that was left at that, it would be, you know, somewhat of an issue. But for many people, their active critic, their inner critic is very active. Active, and has been active for decades. And it's not a very pleasant inner voice, right? And that's to say the least. It can be a very destructive inner voice for many people. So, you know, so we do this retreat, we do workshops on transformation of the inner critic, that part of oneself. So they must have had this, because they're in the hall here other than this. I don't know if everybody can see this, and it looks like it could be one of Thich Nhat Hanh's calligraphies. It makes a very simple statement. Can you read it out loud? You are enough. Just stop a second. I think I found it fascinating, like, inner critic. You are enough. The inner critic doesn't know that, does it? For the inner critic, you are never enough. And also, the critic can also look out in the world and other people, life, and it's never enough. Anybody ever notice that? You know, someone has an inner critic which tells you you're never enough, then it looks at your life and says your life is not enough, you don't have enough of this, you don't have enough of that, you know what I mean? Does that sound familiar? So this is very profound, all in this one statement, you are not enough. So I thought that was interesting because there were so many things I could share with you from this text, but we'll see how far I get. I believe I'm teaching in 2 weeks, so, I mean, there's lots of very wonderful things. So remember, he's in his 30s. He grew up, you know, in a very traditional Vietnamese society, culture. He becomes a monk, right? So very stratified, you know, very clear ways to be, and education, and right? So he's grown up in a very hierarchical, very strong culture, of how to be. Okay? And yet, even in Vietnam, he was a bit of a rebel. He was a young monk, and they were looking at the, you know, also there was a war going on, so that was shaking things up significantly. But he also just took a lot of look at Buddhism and how it was being taught, and he was part of a whole group of young monks and lay people who wanted to reform Buddhism, bring it up to date. And he was running into all kinds of problems. Guess with who? The Buddhist hierarchy, the patriarchy, right? Did not like anybody trying to reform. So he was, so this was going on with him, and then he comes to America, right? And he goes to Cornell and Princeton and, you know, Columbia. And if there's one, you know, we have lots of problems here, but we have historically encouraged what? Freedom of thought, investigation. You know what I mean? It's a very different culture, right? If anything, we go maybe too far the other way in challenging everything. So I also I think, you know, being away from home, seventh, you know, from his culture and, you know, his Vietnamese culture, his monastic culture, he was very much on his own. So the as I say, the journals are very interesting because I think it catches him at a very creative, challenging time for him. So again, I'm just pulled out a few paragraphs, okay? So don't, this is not representative, is it? But really, you find almost all the teachings that he later promulgated in his 100 books, you can see the seeds of them in these journals. So this is a quote. It's funny how much of our surroundings influence our emotions, our joys and sorrows, likes and dislikes, are colored by our environment so much that often we just let our surroundings dictate our course. We go along with quote-unquote public feelings until we no longer even know our own true aspirations. We become a stranger to ourselves, molded entirely by society. And again, I think when we say society, you know, we could say all the societal influences, including, you know, the family and education, you know, all the societal influences. We've become a stranger to ourselves, molded entirely by society. Sometimes I, Thay Nhat Hanh, feel caught between two opposing selves. The quote-unquote false self imposed by society and what I would call my true self. How often we confuse the two and assume society's mold to be our true mold. Battles between ourselves rarely result in peaceful reconciliation. Our mind becomes a battlefield of the five aggregates: forms, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. So the four aggregates are a concept in Buddhist psychology of really what a human being is. Their form, and then they have these four aspects of mind, basically body-mind, but that's what a human being is. Form, body, feelings, perceptions, these formations and consciousness, it becomes a battlefield. And these five aggregates are strewn about like debris in a hurricane. So that's one thing. And then there's other things. This is another quote. I know what it is to get angry. And I know the pleasure of being praised. I'm often on the verge of tears or laughter. But beneath all these emotions, what else is there? How can I touch it? If there isn't anything, why would I be so certain that there is? It reminded me, there was a quote from Viktor Frankl, and he was quoting somebody else where he talked at one point, he said, thirst is the proof that water exists. Very interesting, right? There has to be water somewhere for the thing called thirst to arise in oneself. Everybody understand that? It reminded me because he says, yeah, I know all the moods of life, but I have this feeling that there is more, right? There's more. But I don't know what it is, but just the fact that I have that feeling, that yearning, is proof that there is something. Now, it's interesting because I think that's very common, isn't it, among all of us? You know, years ago, the Freudians, there used to be this guy, Sigmund Freud. Everybody ever hear of Sigmund Freud? They don't teach him much anymore, but he was a major figure when I was getting trained. And of course, you know, he basically, he thought that yearning was coming from our time in the womb. You know, we're floating around in there, right? Very peaceful, you know, totally warm and embraced, you know, in our mother's uterus, you know. And then we, you know, go through that kind of painful process going down the birth canal. And so he saw it as a kind of a psychological problem, you know, that, you know, rather than accepting coming into life, we always yearn to go back to that womb-like safety, right? Some people have seen it as, you know, the innocence of childhood. Everybody remember their early childhood when things were very innocent and pure? Pre-education? When life was all about what? You were all there. Play, right? Life was all about play, very innocent, and it was really kind of nice, wasn't it? As well as, hopefully we had mommy and daddies or somebody to kind of meet our needs, feed us and clothe us and, you know, take us to the doctors and give us our medicine and tuck us in at night, you know? So some people think, oh, that's the yearning, to return to that innocence of childhood. So let's stop a second. Just close your eyes. Is that true? For us, our observation of the world, that no matter what's going on or how good it is, there's always a sense there's something missing. It's very subtle. It's like never complete. Whatever it is, it's never quite enough. There's never enough love. There's never enough praise. There's never enough safety. There's never enough money. There's never enough respect. There's never enough. Ask yourself, do you kind of know that? Now, we often know that when things are kind of messy or difficult, but oftentimes, even when it's not, you often have a sense, oh, there has to be something more, something else. It's kind of a nagging thing. Somehow I'm separate from something. Somehow I'm disconnected. Even when I'm around people or, you know, in situations, there's some kind of disconnection, separateness. Not really feeling part of the whole. Even when it appears that way, it's a kind of a feeling. Maybe more than a feeling. And it again has nothing to do with the quality of your life or how things are going, how your relationships are going. It's like a nagging little thing. It does not, this may not be there all the time, but it just keeps coming up. And again, you know, like the inner critic or that critical voice, you know, that's when it gets very strong. But we're not even talking about that. Just a sense there has to be something more to life. Like he's saying, you know, I know pleasure, I know being praised, I know angry, tears, laughter. Know the normal life, but why do I feel there's got to be something more? How can I touch it? So does that ring a bell with anybody? You can just nod, you don't have to raise your hand. Yeah, it's not pathology, you know. Don't worry, it's not pathological. There's nothing wrong with you. He's talking about something that's deeper. Now, traditionally, one way that people have looked for answers for that is where? Religion. Right? So that's a very strong function of religion, right? To feel that you're part of something bigger. God. Christ. You know, whatever way, you know what I mean? It's, right? So religion has often kind of helped people feel that they're connected to something deeper, right? So religion is that way. But if religion doesn't work for people, how else do people deal with that sense of disconnection or something's missing? Drugs, alcohol, right? Other kinds of things where momentarily, right? We forget about all that. And we think we're having a good time, right? And in our modern society, how else do we deal with that sense of disconnection? Technology. What? Technology. Technology, right. So that's a whole new thing in the last 20, 30 years, right? We can, you know, I mean, the whole promise of, I mean, for those of you, the internet's been around how long? 30 years? 20? What? I don't know if they still do, but in the early days, it was like, this is going to be connectivity. Everybody's going to be connected, feel one, right? Do you remember that? That was the great promise of, and we'd overcome all the barriers because we'll all be connected, right? Shopping, right? Consuming for a moment, we feel what? Connected, we feel good. Working, thank you. Keep busy, 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 working, working, working.
Join a gang.
What, join a gang? Well, yeah, join a gang. Politics, you can throw yourself into all kinds of activities. How about going to a Bucks game? Being part of 60, 80,000 people all, right?
Sure.
I mean, you see there. And yet, there's a problem with all that in Buddhism. You know, that's why he's saying this Ketavi, you know, because the Buddha saw all that, and he, you know, he saw the problem with all of that. He saw right through all of that. And you know what he said the problem was? Impermanence. He said, all of this has a problem. It's all impermanent. Right? You know, you go to the game, your team wins. How do you feel? What? Elated. Right? You feel great. And do you feel connected to all the people who are, you know, Bucks fans? What? Yeah. Great. And how long does that feeling of greatness and connectedness last? Has anybody ever gone to, you know? How long does it last? A couple hours, yeah. And you can keep talking about it a while, you kind of milk it. But eventually it goes, and you're left back with right where you started. And so that's what the Buddha said, you know, that's where. You know, I know what it is to get angry. I know the pleasure of being praised. I'm often on the verge of tears, laughter. But beneath all this, what else is there? How can I touch it? If there isn't anything, how would I be so certain that it is? And so I thought in that other thing that I read first about, you know, our true self and false self, and how society, growing up in society, growing up with societal expectation, familial expectations, academic expectations, personal expectations that the world has for us, people have for us, and that we take on and live our life by, that creates a what? A false self. Why is it a false self? Yeah, because it's something that we have created in relationship to what?
The outside world
and people and their expectations and their models. You know, we have lots of models. So I mean, you know, you can parse it into you know a million different things, but it has to say, yeah. So, you know, that false self is, it's not saying it's bad or good. I mean, I would imagine that he would even say, now I'm speaking for him, that his monastic self was a false self, was a role that he took on based on the expectations, you know, of society, of the religion, of the teachers, of how he was supposed to be as a monk, right? We take on a role as false self. Take on roles as what? Children, parents, siblings, you know, we take on many, many roles, work, you know, we play different roles. How many different roles do you play in your life? What? You know, we play lots of roles. Now, again, that's just life. The problem is, if we think who I am are the roles I play in life, who I really am is the roles I play in life. Can you feel the kind of why there's something missing? Right? Like, so the question becomes, who am I, or who is the one who plays all these roles? You see, that's an interesting question. You know, right? Who is it that's son, father, husband, worker, teacher, you know what I mean? Neighbor, you know all the millions of roles we play. False selves. Again, not bad, you understand? This is not bad. This is just acknowledging, well, that's the way, you know, I've grown up in the society, and these are the kind of roles that were offered to me, and because of my conditioning, these are the roles I took on. Right. But then the question becomes, but then who am I? You know, who's the one who's playing all those roles? Do I know him or her? Often we confuse the two, you know, and again, he talked about these two different selves. Yeah. I mean, I think most people maybe have even forgotten about their true self and just live totally in their false selves. Right. Because nobody's really asking us the question, you know, who really are you? Who is the one behind the mask? And oftentimes, it plays out in an inner struggle. You know, because I truly believe that our true self is always here. Always here. It is we who have turned away from it. It is we who have forgotten it. But it's always here. Just close your eyes. I think, just take a moment just to think about your life. And in our life, you know, we've made choices. I mean, that's being in life, right? Like lots of choices. You know, traditional societies, you didn't have any choices, right? You grew up in a family, you know, men did what their fathers did, women did what their mothers did, right? Marriages were often arranged. You know, it was like not a world of choices. Right? Very limited environment in terms of what you eat and consume. You know, it's like no choices, very few choices. But we live in a world with endless choices. And yet, do we always make the choices coming from deep inside ourselves? Or do we often know that somehow we look at the choices we've made, and we realize, that wasn't me. That wasn't me. You know, I did it because of conditioning. I did it because of fear. I did it because of anger. I did it because of loneliness. I did it because of feeling less than. I did it because of, you know, wanting people's approval. Or I did it because, you know, money. Or I did it because of I wanted to be noticed. Or I did it. Right? Lots of reasons we do things in life. And yet I would suggest to you, if you would take a moment to reflect, that there is something within you that knows more deeply who you are and how you want to be in life. And I'm not saying it's kind of very apparent to you, but I think if you look back, you see, you know, there was always something there. Something that kind of knew. Something that kind of knows, even today. And yet we're not in touch with it, or we don't listen to it. Perhaps there's a reason why, for a lot of people, there's always an inner kind of dis-ease, not ease, deep inside. Somehow we're not living. Somehow the life Sounds strange, not the life we meant, but like sort of like the manifestation of who we are. Can you find that place in yourself? That voice, that feeling. Doesn't matter what's gone on in your life or what's going on, there's a part of you that knows what's really important to you, who you are, which really is most meaningful to you. When you put down the busyness, busy, 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 you put down the activity, active, 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 active. When you put down all the roles, you know, that we play and we played, just put that all down and go, you know, who's the one? Who's the one who's doing all this? Who am I? Do I know that one? Am I in touch with that one? Do I trust that one? Do I listen to that one? Here's another quote from Fragrant Palm Leaves. People cling to the illusion that we are free to be who we want. Yet most of the time, we're merely reacting to the wounds engraved on our hearts, or acting out of our collective karma. It's kind of a Buddhist word, collective karma, but it really means all these societal influences. Almost no one listens to his or her true self. But when we are not ourselves, any freedom we think we have is illusory. Sometimes we reject freedom because we fear it. Our true selves are buried beneath layers of moss and brick. We have to break through these layers and be liberated, but we are afraid it may break us also. We have to remind ourselves over and over again that the layers of moss and brick are not our true selves. Yeah, any comments? Anybody want to courageous enough to say what's going to going on with them as they listen? And people online can just raise their hand, their virtual hand, and Raylin will call on them.
They can just chat.
They'll chat in, right. So Raylin, so just raise your hand and chat in. Yeah, so in the hall, do we have a mic?
Yes.
Back there? No, because we have so many people online, they can't hear you. You gotta. And do me a favor, when you hold the mic, hold it like, you know, like you're a singer. Right in front of you.
I can do that.
All right.
As I was listening to what you were saying, I was thinking that, did I ever fully ever know my true self in the first place?
Yeah.
And what would be some of the ways that I could get in touch with who or what is my true self? I mean, what does that look like? How would I discover, explore who my true self really is?
Perfect question. If That's where we want to go, yeah. Because you're right, I mean, depending on, you know, unless you grew up in a highly unusual family, where your parents were very kind of self-realized people and always nurtured you to kind of be who you were, and the society around you always nurtured you. But most of us do not have that kind. It's very early on we are conditioned, you know, to think a certain way, look as we, you know, and kids are just reacting to what's going on, and yeah. So that's a perfect, that's where we're gonna go. Anybody else? Yes, over here.
Thank you. I feel like this topic really hits me where I live. Mm-hmm. I just have never heard it described so perfectly, that inner struggle. I retired about 5 years ago, and my dream was always to be a professional artist. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered that it's my age or whatever, but what it takes to promote yourself and be successful is, it's really insane what you have to keep up with. And so I let go of that, but I've been just feeling really lost and not knowing. I really have a passion for art, but, you know, and then I think, well, maybe teaching. But it's like I just want something to take the place of that void. And
well, we'll talk about that more deeply.
Yeah.
But that, you know, I guess just responding to you. What is your name?
Patty.
Patty. What I'd say responding to you is, you see, the problem you're having is you go right to the solution. So you're saying, since you retired, you've been in touch with this part of you that wants to create. See, that's very basic, very you. And maybe you haven't listened to that voice. To me, that's where we begin, right? Can I really get in touch with that energy within myself that wants to create? And creativity is very much an act of freedom, isn't it? You see, you can start doing that today. You don't have to wait. That's very important, you know, we don't have to wait.
Thank you.
You know, just get in touch with that and you get out of the way. See, remember you? No freedom in you. You've always been playing roles and you've been containing that energy. And like, get out of the way and let it do what it wants to do. You see, it's like, oh, well, I got to be a professional artist. You know, it's like somebody goes, gee, I really had this, you know, I love to be creative in cooking. Well, then I guess I'll go to chef school. See how immediately we want to contain it. It's like, start cooking. You know, start cooking. Enjoy it. You know, let yourself be free. It's a very different process. But again, we are very constrained. You know, right away we want to contain it and turn it into a profession. Anybody ever remember being a kid? You give a kid crayons and what do? They color. I mean, do they think about, well, I've got to get it just perfect shape and, you know. Anybody a mother of or father of young kids these days? What? What's it like when you give them finger paints, what do? What?
Make a mess.
I mean, my granddaughter, she shows me these pictures. I mean, from a professional point of view, I wouldn't give her much credit. But she thinks they're what? Wonderful. She shows them to you like, look what I did, Grandpa. I mean, can you see how wonderful it is to be a child and not to have criteria about how they should be expressing themselves? Yeah. Anybody online?
Yes, we've got a couple of questions. The first is from Ray. How can we deal with careers and societal expectations that don't fit with our true selves?
Yeah, so it's sort of a little piggybacks on that. Should we get into that? All right, so remember where I started this morning with meditation? And you remember I presented meditation not as a technique? And for many people, they want to learn the technique of meditation, don't they? Because they already go, I'm going to learn the technique of meditation because I heard it's good to reduce stress. Anybody ever hear that? Anybody come here because of that? You could admit it. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. But you can see how narrow that is, you see? Narrow that is. Right? So what I tried to do this morning is present, really in the Buddhist tradition, meditation is a means of knowing your own mind, knowing who you are. And that, when you ask, you know, well, how do you go about it, right? But you got to be very careful because what do we want? See, we're so what? What are we? So what?
Goal-oriented,
solution-focused, right? You know what I mean? It's like, slow down. Slow down. It's very hard. Like, you know, what's the answer, right? What's the solution? I don't know. How do you know, you even know what the real problem is? You know, how do you really know what's causing you to be stressed? How do you really know what's causing you to be unhappy? Are you sure you're right? You see what I'm saying? We could be right away. We go for the solution. So when you sit in meditation, whatever you're doing, just being aware, you're focusing on your body, you're focusing on the breath, you're doing whatever you're concentrating on, whatever you're meditating on, that's all occurring where? In our minds. And if we realize really what I'm doing in meditation is learning how to be present to my mind, learning how to be aware of my mind, learning how to be somewhat concentrated so I don't flip around all over the place, that's what I'm learning. Now, why am I learning this? So I can begin this process of exploration, of really beginning to attend to who I am. To attend to who I am, I have to be willing to what?
Change.
Well, not even change. I mean, that's coming. But the first thing we have to learn how to do is, be present to what I am right now. I mean, how do I know who I am, truly am, if I'm not really in touch with my feelings and my thoughts and my emotions and what's really going on inside me? You know, asking yourself, what do I really feel about this? What do I really think about this? You know, like coming from me, what's really going on in me? So, for example, anybody here because they heard that mindfulness meditation is good for their stress? Come on, anybody want to admit that that's where they came? All right. And you think the cause of your stress is what? I mean, maybe you've been here a little bit, you have changed, but when you came here, you thought the cause of your stress is what?
What I thought it was?
Yeah. I mean, it's where you began.
Everything
coming at you. Work, family, society, right? All right. So it's all coming at me. It's causing me a lot of stress. Somebody told me that this mindfulness meditation can, right? Now, learning meditation and mindfulness could maybe help you cope, but it's still not getting at the cause. Is it? No. So you've been involved with our community for a little bit?
Almost a year.
That's a little bit. Has your understanding of who you are in relationship to your stress changed over that past year?
Exponentially.
Exponentially.
In ways I didn't know.
In ways you didn't know. And how did you find that out?
By sitting and just meditating.
You don't mind me putting you on. Well, you're an educator, so you understand this pedagogical way. That's good. Yeah, so you learned by meditating on your mind. Now, were all your meditations perfect? No. Was your mind totally concentrated and focused all the time? No. But in your attempt to bring some kind of order into that mind of yours, you began to learn about, what's your first name again?
Don.
You began to learn about Don, didn't you? Yeah, Don's making a face like, oh yeah. And you began to learn what's inside Don, in his thoughts and his feelings and perceptions that are really the source of his agitation. So there's the process, the beginning of the process, right? And it's a very difficult process because we live in a society, in a culture where inwardness is not only not taught, but people go like, what's wrong with you? You know what I mean? You used to be such a fun guy. Right? It's just funny. You know, it's like in our society, we get kudos, we get reinforcement for being very busy, being stressed, right? I mean, people get together, you know, for drinks on the weekend, and what do they love to talk about? How stressed they are in work, and you know. I mean, you get what I'm saying? I mean, it's kind of funny. Sometimes there's a competition, you know, who's more stressed? Who works more hours? Well, you think you got it bad. Well, I work. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. So, yeah. Ooh. Yeah. Yeah, we have something a little special today. So I will continue in 2 weeks, but this is the process, right? So, you know, fortunately, Thich Nhat Hanh, he did an incredible thing because he was a monk and, you know, and Vietnamese society was very Confucian. So even growing up in your family, you know, your father, your mother, everybody, very delineated roles and way you know, and how to be. And then he became a monk, which was even more so. So for him writing this way, kind of just opening it all up and exploring his feelings and, you know, his true self. And, you know, this is very radical, right? But if you read it, you realize he was willing to enter the storms. And if you read it, you'll see there were storms. I mean, you know, he's such an even Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, just floating through life. Well, when he was young, he was not floating through life during those years. And he really, you know, stayed with the storm. Now again, I'm not saying that's going to be the same for you, because again, I think he was, we might say, very repressed. You know what I mean? Like he just cut off from kind of those, any kind of inner feelings, because he'd always followed society's, you know, he'd always just followed society's rules. So anyhow, I hope I stirred things up a little bit. You know, but we will continue, and I hope. Yeah, I mean, I see that all the time in interviews, especially with newer people, where all they want to talk to me is about their practice. And I say, well, what's your practice? And they'd say, well, my practice is meditating on my breath. And I go, no. Your practice is healing and transformation. That's your practice. You know, focusing on your breath is a help to that. You know, we have to be bigger. And we have to have a bigger sense of what this is about. So let me stop here. Thank you.